Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. About 4 years ago, Osage Tribal member Randy Tinker Smith heard a suite of music by Osage musician Lou Brock that depicted Osage history from the times prior to European settlement all the way through today. Almost immediately, Smith envisioned a ballet of the story. Of course, ballet holds a particular place of pride in Osage history because of the legacy of the great Maria and Marjorie Tolchy. Well, out of that vision came Wajaje, an Osage ballet, produced by Smith, utilizing the music of Brock and University of Tulsa composer Joseph Rivers, with choreography by Jenna Smith, Smith's daughter. The ballet premiered last summer here in Oklahoma, had performances at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in March, and returns to Tulsa for performances this weekend at the Tulsa PAC. Wajaje, an Osage ballet, is a contemporary ballet that brings together the unique and diverse qualities of Osage history and culture, a reverence for classical ballet, along with the richness of Osage traditional music, dance, and textile arts, with set designs that accurately depict Osage lifestyles, and the costumes are created to appear as the traditional tribal clothing that was worn during the past 200 years. Again, performances are scheduled for this weekend at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. I'm joined by Randy Tinker Smith and Joseph Rivers to talk about Wajaje. Randy Tinker Smith, Joseph Rivers, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Good to be here.
Yeah, Randy, take us back a couple of years when this idea of Wajaje first came to you, this Osage ballet. Tell us how you came up with this idea.
I was working at the Osage Tribal Museum in Pawhuska, and I was putting together a website called OsageTribalMuseum.com along with Lou Brock. And he was writing some music to take over to Arkansas to open the Arkansas Historical Museum. And it was a compilation of songs about the Osage journey. And when I heard those songs, I thought, man, that would make a great ballet. And that's where it started.
What was special about the music?
The emotion that he had in it. I could just see the picture, and it showed the movement from Missouri, what it was is now Missouri, Kansas, and Arkansas, and how we moved down into our reservation.
So once you heard this music, you said, I have to create a ballet? Mm-hmm. Is that what happened?
Yes, and I went to school for interior design, and I played music on the road for 10 years, so I have a lot of art in my background. But my daughter is raised in ballet, and we've done a lot of shows, but Osages are real. We're used to ballet because Maria and Marjorie Tallchief are Osage. Of course, we lost Maria this year.
Yeah. And give us a sense of how the Tallchief's legacy have affected the tribe and members of the tribe. I know it's a source of pride.
It's a great source of pride because they were phenomenal. And the New York City Ballet came from Maria Tallchief. She was at the very beginnings of that. And Balanchine wrote pieces just for her.
Yeah.
And so I've heard my friends say in the villages that growing up, all the little girls were wanting to be ballerinas, which is unique to Native Americans.
Yeah, I think so. So once you had this idea, how did you go about putting it together? Because now it has been put together. You've done performances here this past summer, performances at the Smithsonian, at the Museum for the American Indian, and now again this summer here in Oklahoma.
Well, I spent about a year meeting with 50 different Osage elders. And first of all, I wanted to ask permission if I could tell the story and what I was allowed to tell and what I was not allowed to tell. Because in our tribe, we're unique in that when we came over in 1871 to our reservation, those elders put away all our old ceremonies. The men and women had tattoos. Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore. They decided we're just going to quit doing these ways and we're going to take on these European ways.
I see. So a lot of the old pre-Columbian, if you will, ceremonies were basically locked away.
Yes, and it was a decision of our elders to put them away.
And that's continued to this day?
Yes. So we're very careful not to, in our pre-contact scenes, we show the joy. Because if you read old diaries, they say, oh, Osages were the happiest people in the world. So we really try to get that across on the stage and how they never married within clans. So we show the different clans coming together and how they bring gifts and how they have this marriage of clans. And that's how we had such a pure-blooded people. They were so gorgeous, almost 7 feet tall, mm-hmm. because of they would not mix the clans.
as you were talking with the elders, what were their concerns other than maybe these old stories that and these old ceremonies they didn't want depicted on stage?
Well, remember at that time, because of the disease that came in, the fences had been put up, the buffalo had been slaughtered. They felt that if they went back to their old ceremonies, they could lose their children again. Mm-hmm. And so when they said, we are going to put this away, they meant it. We are putting this away. So I have to obey them because they're my elders and do what they want me to do. And we just have gone forward. We're a very forward-looking tribe. And they said, let's get our kids educated. We built our own boarding schools many times and paid for them and made sure that these kids were set up for success in this new world because they knew it was inevitable.
So I guess the tribal elders gave their blessing at some point for this project?
Yes. And they've watched me very closely. But I had a lot of them came to all four opening performances last year. Uh-huh. And I've had some really great feedback. I think where I've seen the tribe really getting behind me is in the age group from about high school to the 35 age group, because these kids are really yearning to hang on to what culture that we do have left, and they're real respectful, and they want to see our tribe continue. And this paints a vivid picture of who we are. Mm-hmm. It's a true Osage history shown and taught by Osages.
Now, as you were putting the ballet together, what were the important sort of points that you wanted to get across in the ballet? Again, I think you mentioned some of them, the fact that prior to European meeting, the Osages were a fairly happy tribe. What did you want? What were the important points you wanted to tell as the ballet progressed?
We show vividly how happy they were in pre-contact, and then those settlers coming in and really pushing. We show them literally pushing them back. And how the changes coming in with the Spaniards and then the French and the other Europeans coming in and just pushing them back and that transition going into. And it was hard. One of the things they said when we were in Kansas right before coming into Oklahoma, the women, the cries of the mothers lamenting the deaths of their children, because my great-grandfather was born there at the mission in Kansas. And there was one in a diary, it talks about 600 Osages died in 1 week. So we tried.
Disease, like smallpox?
Disease. Mm-hmm. And what had happened in Missouri, when they had to move from Missouri to Kansas, they had to leave the graves of their children. And robbers came in and stole their bones even to mm-hmm. show in museums. So when it happened in Kansas, and they moved down to Oklahoma, it was just a very chaotic time because whole clans died. So we don't even have some of those clans left today.
So you depict that in the story.
Yes.
And then, of course, once you get to Oklahoma, I think I read in the synopsis that the elders had dreams of a black substance oozing to the ground. And so when they did settle in Oklahoma, they held on to mineral rights.
Thankfully, they did that. They said, we're going to own everything under a foot forever and still do today. And what happened is when oil was struck there, tens of thousands of people moved in because people go where the money is. I don't think people understand Osages became the richest people in the entire world. Here's a people that don't even understand ownership because they live communally. They don't own land. They don't want to own land. The Europeans are trying to turn them into farmers and give them their little 600 acres and put a fence around it. So you're going to live right there. Well, they hunted from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. And to be stuck in this small amount, that was hard. So we try to show that. And what came with the wealth, of course, was people want their money. So literally, a car salesman would come up to you and say, hey, Mr. Osage Indian, I know you bought a car for me last week, but my child's sick. Will you buy another car this week because I really need help with my hospital bill? Oh, sure. Yeah. And the car would be parked there. No, it may not even know. They'd hire people to drive them. They just didn't care. They didn't care about owning stuff. So it was easy to take advantage of our people. And finally, one banker out of Fairfax, he had his nephews, and they started a ring and started marrying and murdering Osages.
The Osage Reign of Terror, yes.
So if you picture, as a women are married, and they know that they could possibly be married to someone who is going to murder their family. It was just a time of such unease because they had just only recently become humans according to the law of the American law in 18 Standing Bear 40 something.
Uh-huh.
So they knew the law wasn't going to help them. But thankfully, President Hoover had gone to boarding school with an Osage, and one of the first acts of the FBI was to come into the Osage reservation and find the murderers.
Of course, the ballet ends with this idea of Osage moving forward, and I think there's a metaphor of a foot in both worlds.
We walk in two worlds. And actually, when we went to the Smithsonian, we had a lot of people from other tribes see our show, and it surprised me that that's what's touching people's hearts, especially Native Americans, because we do have mixed blood, and we walk. Indians walk at a certain cadence, a different cadence than Europeans, and you feel kind of this tug of war in your own body, in your own mind. And this is, I think, what they relate to the most and what touches their hearts. And at the very end, when we have Christopher in his suit and tie and his briefcase walking across the stage, and then he hears a drum and starts Indian dancing.
Uh-huh.
And the sun sets.
Yeah. It sounds like a really interesting piece, and you have original music, you also have original costumes, and you were talking about the young people of the Osage tribe, and one of the things you did as you were putting this production together was you used the resources of the tribe, elders who know the old traditions of, you know, of cloth making and, you know, all the old crafts, and you had young people coming together to make the costumes.
Right. Wendy Ponca has been a guest teacher at the National Museum of the American Indian, and she and Terry Wan did our costumes. And we did a lot of work at the Cultural Center, and this is an educational project. So every aspect of it we work on teaching, and to have these elders come in and talk, you know, about the ribbon work and making sure that the costumes looked authentic, and they are costumes. They're not our Osage clothes. They're made for ballet. And the roaches, which is the headgear that our men wear, and the paint, how to paint the men, because that was kind of went away with the old ceremony. So we just had to do our best not to copy any ceremonies. So a lot, every aspect of, we brought in Osages, our backdrops were done out in a pasture in Fairfax. We prayed for it not to rain, and Alexandra Ponca, she got out there with her roller, and it's 50 feet across, and did this on the ground.
Wow.
And it is stunning. They are stunning, those backdrops are.
Mm-hmm. So what did the kids learn from spending time with the elders, you know, working on costumes and getting the details right?
Well, remember, we're telling our story. So in this ballet, you're learning a lot of history. One thing, it sounds, you know, strange maybe, but we're a very respectful people. And those kids, we reminded them about that respect of their elders. And they like that. They like being reminded of who we are and how we behave. So even in the little things, we tried to teach every step of the way.
My guest today is Randy Tinker-Smith, the producer of Wajaje, an Osage ballet, which takes place this weekend with performances tonight and tomorrow at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Also, we have Joseph Rivers, who helped work with Lou Brock in orchestrating the music. And I did you compose some music as well, or a little bit of music?
Yes. Basically, the process was Randy was developing the project and inspired originally by Lou Brock's music. She came to me with the idea of adapting the orchestrating the music, perhaps adding some of my own music as needed. So we went through the music and decided which which themes were had the most dramatic impact for ballet, and chose among his themes the Missouri theme, the pre-contact theme, the love theme, and marriage theme, and the ragtime sort of Charleston style theme of Pawhuska Oil, and the very moving Reign of Terror and funeral scene.
And now, then, had he written this music already for sort of telling this story in some way?
Yes, he had. Actually, he had created a sequence of movements telling the Osage story. And so from that, we selected, consulting with Randy, which themes that she would like to use in the ballet and which ones, what movements would she like original new music.
Now, were they written in... I assume, like, in a Native American motif, or were they written more in Western European styles?
It's actually the adapted and orchestrated music are in a Western style with elements, with Native elements, such as the drumming, the use of the bells, the rhythm. And so there's a suggestion of it. So there's this connection, you might say, of two worlds, even in the music. There are some of the movements, in fact, the opening scene is based on a traditional tribal song, drumming and singing. So there's some of the traditional music in it, too. But the orchestra music is a mixture of Lou's music and my music. I created some new themes for the warrior themes and a few of the other movements as well. So there is a definite mix. Some of the movements are based on my music, some on Lou's music.
Now, did you, as you were working with the company, did you have a sense of what the story was going to be? Was there actually working with the choreographer to determine the length of pieces and adapting your raw music for the final form of the ballet?
That's right. We sat down with Randy and with Jenna, the choreographer, at varied times, and I had a synopsis of each scene, but we went through each one at a time, and I either adapted music and orchestrated or composed new music or a mixture. And so she would sign it off or say, well, we need this change. We need to do this here. It's somewhat like a film score, just one cue at a time, scene at a time. And so once we went through scene by scene, by the time we got to the end, then I remixed it and re-recorded it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Randy, I assume there's a mix of traditional ballet, contemporary ballet, and then traditional dance. Is would that be fair to say in this piece?
Yes, and I think because it took me about 2 years to get to the point where we started choreography, Jenna had heard the story so many times, she already had choreography in her mind, and I think by divine design, it was supposed to be choreographed by an Osage, and you can really see the feel of the bodies and how Osages move. And going back to what Joseph was talking about, she would sit next to him in the studio, and she says, this is what they're doing, and this is what they're feeling, and he would write that music right around that choreography, and he's brilliant. It was just amazing to see that.
Well, are she melding the three types of dance, or is it... You know, will there be a piece that's more traditional dance, another that's maybe traditional ballet, another that's, contemporary dance, or is it sort of a molding of the three styles?
She's raised very old-school ballet, serious ballet. So there's a lot of true ballet, but then there's some contemporary elements in there because of the passion involved in some of the scenes. And we actually have Osage Indian dancing in there as well. So, yes, all three.
Now, once you got the piece up and running last summer, you did some performances. Tell us about the invitation to the Smithsonian. I mean, that must have been a great honor. And where did you perform in Washington?
We were at the National Museum of the American Indian. And my goal in this whole project was to get a video of it and take it out to tribes all over the country, hoping to inspire kids up to their artistic endeavors, whatever it is, music, dance, running the stage, anything, backdrops. But they knew we were doing this project and invited us out, and we felt so honored to be able to do it at a national stage. And we were able to reach out to people from all over the world and even had someone from Romania come, a man, weeping, and said he could relate to our story. Uh-huh. And so I think it's reaching. There's a healing that's involved when people watch the show, especially from Native Americans, the things that our people have gone through. There's a healing that takes place when they watch our show.
Yeah, well, every tribe has gone through this experience to some extent. You share these common elements. My guest today, Randy Tinker Smith, the producer of Wajaje, an Osage ballet, which made its premiere last year. Performances in Bartlesville and Tulsa last year. Then they went to the Smithsonian in March for some performances in Washington, D.C. They were reprising the performances last weekend in Bartlesville and this weekend at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. And Joseph Rivers, who helped compose the music, also our guest today. Well, tell us a little bit about the cast. You have some dancers from the Osage. Some dancers come from, good part of the country. I mean, Texas, I saw Georgia, several different locations. Tell us a little bit about the dancers.
I had networked it for about 6 months looking for Osage ballet dancers, and sadly we just don't have very many. We have a few.
Yeah.
And also because of professional dancers are in a contract, what is our school year, August to May. So we were able to find some from San Diego Ballet, Texas Ballet, Georgia Ballet. And they came in, and they were really, they've learned our story, and they're honored to do it, and they really portray the story well. And this year, we auditioned, and we brought in 19 more kids that are mostly Osage. And I think they add a real beautiful element because we want to show the whole family structure. Osage is all about family. And those kids, I think, they're like the jewelry of the ballet. They just look beautiful. They carry themselves beautifully.
So they add a lot to the show.
Yes.
All right. Well, what are the plans for this ballet after these set of performances? Is it something you're hoping to take on tour at some point, or is this sort of the culmination of this experience, or what exactly?
Well, I had set a firm goal to take the video out to other tribes, but as soon as it performed the first time, people called us and wanted us to show it again. And they're looking at us to go to Missouri. St. Louis is having their 250th anniversary next year.
Mm-hmm.
They'd like us to come perform for that. Also, because of the interest in the tribe, it looks like we're going to think about opening a ballet studio in Pawhuska for that rural area for our three villages, so we can start raising up Osage ballet dancers. And as soon as we get done with these performances, we'll regroup and figure out exactly what direction we're going, because it's very expensive to take 50 people on tour.
Yes, it is. And what's the tribe leadership's response to this piece? I mean, obviously they've been at all the opening performances. They must be very proud of it.
They are. It's a very positive, non-political, artistic endeavor, and we've been getting really good. People appreciate it. They love that we've come together as a tribe and that we are doing something so positive. And finally being able to tell our own story.
A lot of other people have appropriated the Osage story. You know, everything from the FBI story, you know, the old movie, to, you know, books about the Osage Reign of Terror. It's good that you're telling your own story. It is good.
Yes.
All right. Well, we wish you success. Performances tonight, tomorrow, and then Sunday afternoon at the Williams Theater of the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Randy and Joseph, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Thanks for having us.
Producer Randy Tinker Smith and composer Joseph Rivers speaking about Wajaje, an Osage ballet, which has performances tonight through Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's John H. Williams Theater. Ticket information available at tulsapac.com. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
I love radio. I love sitting in this claustrophobic studio and speaking into this microphone, knowing my words and the sound of my voice travel to places unseen and people unknown. It reminds me that the radio waves that turn into the best sounds are made by real people earnestly trying to entertain, challenge, and inform. The AM radio in the car I drove in high school picked up only four stations in the rural town where I lived. One played old fogies music like my parents enjoyed. One ran only country and western discs. One was the local station, and the last was WLS out of Chicago. The DJs from up north talked about the loop, the big city, the places I'd never been, but I'd listened to WLS because it played rock and roll. If I had stayed in my hometown, though, the local station probably would have become the default setting on my radio dial. On the morning program, you could hear news from the most recent school board or garbage authority meeting. The announcer might report updates from the highway being built south of town. He would definitely read the daily school lunch menus. And for today's dessert, he'd intone with barely hidden scorn, wacky cake. A mid-morning DJ would play hillbilly music too raw even for the big city country music stations, and at noon, listeners heard the daily agriculture report. I never understood what that guy said, except that some days pork bellies were up and KC Red was down. By mid-afternoon, the playlist had mellowed. The sound shifted to rock and roll and pop with the evening rotation. Then, in the wee hours of early morning, the teenage DJ who thought no one was listening would drop the needle on Iron Butterfly's Inagata De Vita and play all 18 minutes of it. You never knew what you might encounter on that local radio. The hillbilly gospel song of Stark Beauty played once and never heard again. The flip side of Doris Day's Que Sera Sera, a bizarre guitar solo at midnight. Okay, some of it was Drek, but that's the way real life is, sublime and ridiculous. Local radio's sheer randomness would have made it my preferred radio setting. In the last two decades, however, ownership of radio signals has consolidated. Fewer locally owned or operated stations now exist. The DJ's voice you hear speaking on a Tulsa station may actually be coming from Denver. These new corporate owners all employ sophisticated marketing analysis and computer algorithms to broadcast what listeners say they want to hear. But when these marketing strategies were initially implemented, interestingly, the massive broadcasting companies discovered a paradox. The more the stations played what listeners said they wanted to hear, the greater their ratings fell. You see, the reason the local station of my youth would garner my attention now is because those who ran it understood, either consciously or subconsciously, the great conundrum of radio broadcasting, which is, what I think I want to hear may not actually be what I want to hear. And that may be the great conundrum of life. What I think I want may not actually be what I want.
Mark Dara is a local attorney and writer and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, at Studio Tulsa for today, our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.